Chapter 3, which is quite superfluous. As a matter of fact, these were not thoughts, but a sort of contemplation, arbitrary notions, daydreams even, of this and that and nothing else. To begin with, I made a mental journey back to olden times and let my thoughts wander, particularly on the subject of the man who had made the above aphorism about the rationality of Frenchmen. It was, in fact, the aphorism that gave rise to these otherwise aimless thoughts. For his day, that man held very progressive ideas. But though he did go about all his life bedecked in the dress of a French gentleman, powdered wig and a little sword to show his knightly descent, which was entirely foreign to us, and to defend his personal honour in Potemkin's waiting-room, no sooner did he poke his nose abroad than the very name of Paris became anathema to him, and he decided that Frenchmen were not rational, and that they would even consider it most unfortunate if they were. By the way, you do not by any chance imagine, do you, that I mentioned the sword and the velvet coat as a reproach to von Wiesen? Because I certainly did not. He could not, after all, put on a Russian peasant coat, particularly at that time, when even now certain persons, in order to be Russian and merge with the people, do not put on a peasant coat, but have instead invented a ballet dress for themselves, little different from the type worn in Russian national operas by the various uslads in love with their Ludmillas wearing kokoshniks, a headdress traditionally worn by Russian women. At least a French coat was nearer to the people's understanding of things. "You can see he's a gentleman," they would say. "What else should a gentleman wear? A peasant's coat or something?" I heard a short time ago that one modern landowner, in order to merge with the people, also took to wearing Russian dress, and even going to village meetings in it. But the peasants, as soon as they saw him coming, would say to each other, "What's this fellow in fancy dress barging in here for?" So that landowner had no success in merging with the people. "I shall certainly not make any concessions," a friend said to me. "I certainly shan't, not me. I will make a point of not wearing a beard, and I'll go about in white tie and tails if necessary. I'll do all the work that must be done, but I shall not so much as hint at friendly relations. I'll be the boss, stingy and thrifty. I'll be a shark and a leech if need be. They'll respect me all the more. And this surely is the main thing, real respect." "Damn it all," I said to myself. "It all sounds as if they were getting ready to march against enemy tribes, a sort of war council, that is." "Well," said a third man, a charming man, as a matter of fact, to me, "suppose I made myself a member of some peasant organization, and the village council ordered me to be flogged or something or other. What then?" "And even if it did," I wanted suddenly to say, but did not, because I was afraid to, "what is this? Why are we still sometimes afraid to express some of our thoughts?" "Even if the council did give that order," I thought to myself, "and they did flog you, what of it? Professors of aesthetics call such a turn of events the tragic side of life, and that is all there is to it. Surely a little thing like that does not warrant a whole life spent aloof from everyone else. Oh, no, if we want to be all together, let us really all be together. And if we want to be aloof, let us be completely aloof. Elsewhere, people had been through a good deal worse, women and children, too." "Come, come now, women and children, indeed," my opponent would exclaim. "The village council might have me flogged just like that, for no reason at all, because of another man's cow, perhaps, that had crashed into someone else's vegetable garden, and you set it out as a general proposition." It sounds funny, of course, and besides, it is a funny business altogether, a dirty business. I don't want to soil my hands with it. It's hardly decent even to talk of it. To hell with them all. Let them all be whipped, as far as I am concerned. It has nothing to do with me. As a matter of fact, so far as I'm concerned, I can absolutely answer for the village council. My charming controversialist would not get so much as one little whack if it were possible to deal with him according to the council's decision. Let's take a money fine off him, fellows. He's gentry after all, not used to this sort of thing. Now we are a different matter. Our backsides are made for flogging. That is how the council would decide, in the words of the village mayor in one of Chedrin's provincial sketches. Reaction, someone will cry on reading this. Fancy putting up a defence of flogging. Honest to God, someone will deduce from this that I'm standing up for flogging. Come now, another man may say. What are you talking about? You wanted to tell us about Paris, and now you have gone right off the track to tell us about flogging. What has Paris got to do with it? What's all this? A third man might add. You admit yourself that you heard about these things quite recently, yet you were travelling in the summer. How then could you have thought about all this in your railway carriage? Quite right, I would reply. This really is a problem. But let me see now. These are winter reminiscences of summer impressions. And some winter impressions got mixed up with the winter reminiscences. Besides, as the train was approaching Eitkunen, my thoughts were particularly concentrated on all things Russian, which I was abandoning for the sake of seeing Europe, and I remember meditating in that strain. The theme of my relations was, in fact, the following. What kind of imprint did Europe leave on us at different times? Why did it constantly try to gatecrash upon us with its civilization? How civilized have we become, and precisely how many of us have so far become civilized? I can now see that all this is somehow unnecessary. But then I did warn you beforehand that the whole chapter was unnecessary. But anyway, where did I stop? Oh yes, discussing a French coat. That is what it all started with. Well now, one of these French coats at the time wrote The Brigadier. The Brigadier was a marvellous thing by the standards then prevailing, and created an extraordinary effect. Potemkin himself said, "You may as well die now, Denis. Never will you write anything better." People began to stir, as if roused from sleep. "I wonder," I continued, letting my thoughts take their own course, "were people even then tired of doing nothing, tired of a life in leading strings?" I do not mean merely the French leading strings of the time, and would anyway like to add that we are a very credulous nation, and that it all comes of our being so good-natured. We might, for instance, be all sitting idly round doing nothing, and then suddenly take it into our heads that somebody had said or done something worthwhile. We might imagine that we too could be original, and that we have found something to do, and then we would all get excited in the absolute conviction that now it is all going to begin. A fly might buzz past, and we are quite ready to take it for an elephant. It is, of course, due to youthful inexperience and dearth of native tradition. In Russia, that sort of behaviour can be traced almost further back than the Brigadier, though it was then naturally only in its rudimentary stages, but it continues to the present day. We find something to do, and then give squeals of delight. Squealing and bursting from sheer delight, that's what we really go in for. And yet, a couple of years later, we slink off again, looking sheepish. But we never get tired and are always ready to begin again. As to other leading strings, practically no one in von Wiesen's time had the slightest doubt that these were the most sacred, the most European of leading strings, and the best of all possible tutelage. Of course, there are few doubters even now. The whole of our ultra-progressive party is frantically in favour of foreign leading strings. But then, oh then, it was a time of such faith in all kinds of leading strings that it is a wonder we did not move mountains then. It is odd indeed that all these Alaun Downs and Pargulava Heights and Valdai Peaks of ours still stand where they have always stood. True enough, a poet of the time did say about one of his characters that mountains groaned when he lay on them. He cast towers high over clouds. But that, it seems, was merely a metaphor. By the way, my dear sirs, I have only one type of literature in mind at the moment, the type known as belles lettres. It is through literature that I want to trace Europe's gradual and beneficial influence on our country. Just what books were then, before and at the same time as the Brigadier, published and read, we cannot even conceive without feeling rather pleasantly superior. We now have a most remarkable writer, the pride of our time, a certain Kuzma Prutkov. His only defect consists in a modesty that passeth all understanding. He has not yet published his complete works. Well now, a long time ago he wrote Sketches by My Grandfather, which appeared in a miscellany published by The Contemporary. Just imagine the sort of thing that could have been written at the time by this debonair septuagenarian, who had lived in the reign of Catherine the Great, who had seen a thing or two in his life, who had been at court, who had fought at Acharkov, and who had now retired to his ancestral farm and taken to writing his memoirs. He certainly had something to write about, that man, all the things he had witnessed in his life. Yet his book is composed entirely of such little stories as the following. The Witty Answer of the Chevalier de Montbazon. A very attractive young lady once coolly asked the Chevalier de Montbazon in the king's presence, "Can you tell me, my lord, whether a dog is attached to its tail or the tail to the dog?" To which the Chevalier, being quick at repartee, and therefore not in the slightest confused, replied in an even tone of voice, "There is no rule, madam, forbidding a man to catch a dog either by its tail or by its head." This reply gave the king much pleasure, and the Chevalier did not go unrewarded. You think that all this is stuff and nonsense, and that an old man like that never really existed in this world, but I promise you that when I was 10 years old, I myself and with my own eyes read a book written in the great Catherine's time which contained the following story. The Witty Answer of the Chevalier de Rohan. It is a well-known fact that the Chevalier de Rohan suffered from very bad breath. One day, when he was present at a levee of the Prince de Condé, the latter said to him, "Do not stand quite so near, Chevalier, for you smell most unpleasantly." To which the Chevalier immediately gave answer, "Not I, your most gracious Highness, but rather you, for you have just come out of bed." Now, just try and imagine that old man living on his land, a seasoned warrior who had lost an arm, perhaps, surrounded by his old wife, his country bumpkin children, and 100 servants, steaming himself every Saturday in his Russian bath till he is purple in the face. There he is, with his glasses on his nose, gravely and enthusiastically reading this kind of story, and imagining it to be the very essence of culture into the bargain. Indeed, thinking himself almost in duty bound to read it. What a naive faith they then had in the utility of such news from Europe and the necessity of it. "It is," they said, "a well-known fact that the Chevalier de Rohan suffered from bad breath." To whom was it well known? Why was it well known? What bumpkin somewhere in the backwoods of Russia knew it so well? And anyway, who would want to know it? But such revolutionary thoughts never disturbed the old man. With the most childlike faith, he would decide that this collection of witty stories was well known at court, and that would be quite sufficient so far as he was concerned. Oh, certainly we found it easy to assimilate Europe then, in the physical sense, of course. It was difficult to avoid using the whip when it came to moral assimilation. People would put on silk stockings and wigs, attach swords to themselves, and look for all the world like Europeans. And not only was it not felt as an encumbrance, but it was, in fact, liked. And yet in practice everything remained as before. Once Rohan, of whom all that was known was that he had very bad breath, was laid aside, and spectacles were taken off, people still dealt with their servants, as before their attitude to their family was still as patriarchal, as before. They still had the neighbouring farmer thrashed in the stables, as before, if he was poorer than they and happened to say something rude, still demeaned themselves in the presence of their superiors, as before. Even the peasant understood it all better. His masters despised him less, held his customs and habits in less contempt, knew more about him, were not strangers to him to the same extent, not foreigners quite as much. And as to them throwing their weight about in his presence, what else could you expect? That's what they were the masters for. They may have thrashed their peasants to death, but the people liked them better all the same, because they were nearer to them somehow. In fact, all these fellows were simple, sturdy folk, never in anything tried to go to the root of the matter, grabbed, thrashed, stole, fondly sweated their peasants, and went through life peacefully in fat contentment and in conscientious and childish debauch. I even suspect that all those grandfathers of ours were not all that innocent, even in that little matter of the Rohans and the Montbazons. Some of them were great rogues even, and knew their own worth when it came to all these European influences from above. All that fantastic make-believe, all that masquerading, all those French coats, cuffs, wigs, swords, all those fat, clumsy legs thrust into silk stockings, those little soldiers in German wigs and boots, all this, it seems to me, was a great swindle, so that even the simple people sometimes noticed it and understood. Of course, one can be a clerk or a swindler or a brigadier, and yet be innocently and touchingly convinced that the Chevalier de Rohan is in fact the very embodiment of the most exquisite refinement. But then this did not prevent anyone from behaving as they always did. The Gvozdilovs bullied as they had always done. Our Potemkin and others of his ilk very nearly had our Rohans thrashed in their stables. Our Montbazons fleeced the quick and the dead, boxed people's ears with lace-cuffed fists, and kicked their backsides with silk-stockinged feet. And our marquises at court levees rolled about on the floor in valiant disregard of bumps on their heads. In short, all this Europe, bespoke and to order, managed surprisingly well to achieve a harmonious coexistence among us, beginning with St. Petersburg, the most fantastic town with the most fantastic history of all towns on this planet. But nowadays it is no longer the same, and St. Petersburg has triumphed. Nowadays we have come up to standard and are fully fledged Europeans. Nowadays Gvozdilov himself uses skill when doing his bullying, keeps up appearances, is becoming a French bourgeois, and before long will take to quoting texts to defend the slave trade like any American from the southern states of the USA. As a matter of fact, the habit of quoting texts in self-defense is now increasingly reaching Europe from the United States. When I get there, I said to myself, I shall see it with my own eyes. You can never learn from books as much as you can see with your own eyes. By the way, talking of Gvozdilov, why did van Wiesen put one of the most remarkable phrases in his Brigadier not into the mouth of Sophia, who in that comedy represents the idea of noble, humane, and European progress, but into the mouth of the Brigadier's inane wife, whom he made into such a fool, and a reactionary fool at that, not just a fool, that all the threads are there for everyone to see, and all the inanities she says seems to be said not by her, but by someone else hiding behind her back. But when the truth had to be said, it was not Sophia who said it, but the brigadier's wife. After all, he made her not only into a perfect fool, but into a bad woman as well. And yet he seemed afraid, and even considered it artistically impossible that such a phrase should pop out of the mouth of Sophia with her hothouse plant upbringing. Instead, he apparently considered it more natural that it should have been uttered by a simple, stupid woman. Here is the passage, it is worth recalling. It is very curious, and is made so by the fact that it was written with no end in view, not even tongue-in-cheek, naively, and perhaps even accidentally. The brigadier's wife says to Sophia, "We had a captain in our regiment who commanded Number 1 Company. His name was Gvozdilov, and he had such a pretty little wife. Well now, would you believe it, my dear, whenever he lost his temper, or was drunk, rather, he used to bully her within an inch of her life, and would never tell her what for. It was none of my business, of course, but I used to weep my eyes out sometimes looking at her." Sophia: "Pray, madam, stop telling us things so revolting to humanity." Brigadier's wife: "There you are, my dear. You don't even want to hear about it. And how do you think the captain's wife felt, who had to bear it?" Thus, for all her good manners and sensibility, Sophia is made to look a fool by the side of a simple and common woman. This is one of Van Wiesen's remarkable repartees, or retorts, and he has nothing neater, more human, and more accidental. And we still have a countless number of such hothouse progressives among the most advanced of our public men, who are very well satisfied with their hothouses and demand nothing better. But the most remarkable thing of all is that Gvozdilov still bullies his wife, and does it almost in greater comfort than before. He does, really. They say it used to be done in greater amity and with more kindness. "To love is to thrash," says the proverb. Wives, they say, became quite worried if they were not beaten. "He doesn't beat me means he doesn't love me," they said. But all this is primitive and elemental, harking back to the times of our ancestors. Nowadays, even this is subject to progress. Nowadays, Gvozdilov bullies almost out of principle, and then only because he is still a fool, that is, an old-fashioned man who has failed to keep up with the times. The reason why I expatiate on the theme of Gvozdilov is that people in this country still write paragraphs about him full of profound meaning and human understanding, and they write so much that the public is tired of them. Gvozdilov is sufficiently tenacious of life to be almost immortal. Oh yes, he is alive and kicking, drunk and replete. Now he has only one arm and one leg left, and, like Captain Kopeikin, has shed his blood in a manner of speaking. His wife has long ago ceased to be the pretty young thing she used to be. She has grown old, and her face is pale, haggard, and furrowed by wrinkles and suffering. But when her husband, the captain, lay ill after the loss of his arm, she never left his bedside, spent sleepless nights watching over him, comforted him, wept bitter tears over him, and called him her dear, her valiant knight, the darling of her heart, her own soldier, bold and brave. It may, oh it may, arouse our indignation from one point of view, but from another, long live the Russian woman! There is nothing better in our Russian world than her limitlessly forgiving love. For that is so, is it not? Particularly as nowadays Gvozdilov, too, when he is sober, does not always beat his wife, or rather beats her less frequently, keeps up a semblance of decency, and even has an occasional tender word for her. For he has become aware in his old age that he cannot do without her. He is thrifty and bourgeois, and if he does give her a beating, even now, it is only when he is drunk, or else out of habit, when he feels bored. And this certainly is progress, whatever you say, which is a comfort, and we love so much being comforted. Oh yes, we are quite comforted now, and we have succeeded in comforting ourselves. It may be that reality around us looks none too lovely even yet, but then we are so wonderful ourselves, so civilized, so European, that the common people feel sick at the very sight of us. We have now reached the point when the common people regard us as complete foreigners, and do not understand a single word of ours, a single look of ours, a single thought of ours. And this certainly is progress, whatever you say. We have now reached the point where our contempt for the common people and the basic principles of its being is so profound that even our attitude to it is stamped with a new, unprecedented and kind of supercilious disdain which did not exist even at the time of our Montbazons and Rouens. And this certainly is progress, whatever you say. And then how self-confident we now are in our civilizing mission. With what an air of superiority we solve all problems, and what problems! There is no soil, we say, and no people. Nationality is nothing but a certain system of taxation. The soul is a tabula rasa, a small piece of wax out of which you can readily mould a real man, a world man or a homunculus. All that must be done is to apply the fruits of European civilization and read two or three books. And then how serene, how majestically serene we are, because we have solved all problems and written them off. With what smug self-satisfaction, for instance, we have trounced Turgenev for his refusal to make his peace with the world together with us, for his refusal to be satisfied with our majestic personalities and accept them as his ideal, and for having sought something better than us. Better than us? Good God! But what can be lovelier and more faultless than us in this sublunar world? He certainly got into hot water over Bazarov. Bazarov, restless and troubled, sign of a great heart, despite all his nihilism. We have even trounced him for his Kukshina, for that progressive louse which Turgenev had combed out of Russian reality for us to look at, and we accused him of opposing the emancipation of women into the bargain. All this is certainly progress, whatever you say. Now we stand over the common people with the self-assurance of corporals or sergeant majors of civilization. It is a delight to look at us. Arms akimbo and glance defiant, we look really cocky, and we say to the peasant with all the contempt we can muster, "Nationality and national community all boil down to political reaction and the assessment of taxes. So what of you to teach us, you old lout?" For really, we cannot be expected to pander to prejudice. Oh, goodness me. Let us assume for a minute, my dear sirs, that my travels are over and I am back in Russia, and let me tell you a story. One day this autumn, as I was reading a newspaper, one of the most progressive ones, I noticed the following news from Moscow. Heading, "More Relics of Barbarism," or something like this, very sharply worded. Unfortunately, however, I haven't got the newspaper in front of me now. Well, anyway, the story as told there was that one morning this autumn an open carriage was espied in the streets of Moscow. A drunken woman, a professional matchmaker by occupation, was sitting in the carriage all beribboned and singing a song. The coachman was also bedecked in some sort of ribbons, was also drunk, and was also caterwauling as best he could. Even the horse was adorned with ribbons. I don't know, though, whether it was drunk. It probably was. The woman was holding a bundle, the contents of which she was going to exhibit and which belonged to a newly married couple who had obviously passed a happy night together. The bundle, of course, contained a certain light garment which, among the lower classes, is usually shown the following day to the bride's parents. People laughed at the sight of the matchmaker woman, and a gay sight it was. Indignantly, forcefully, and contemptuously, the newspaper related this unheard-of barbarism, which has survived to this day in spite of the progress of civilization. I admit that I burst out laughing. Oh, please, do not think that I'm trying to defend primitive cannibalism. Light garments, veils, etc. It is bad, it is unchaste, it is uncivilized, it is Slav. I know all that, and I agree. Though, of course, it was not done with evil intent, but merely as a part of marriage celebrations and out of natural simplicity and ignorance of anything better, loftier, more European. Oh no, I laughed at something else. I laughed because I suddenly remembered our ladies and our fashionable dress shops. Of course, civilized ladies no longer send their light garments to their parents, but when it comes to ordering a dress at a dressmaker's, how cunningly and efficiently they know how to pad certain parts of their charming European dress with cotton wool. What is the cotton wool for? Naturally, for the sake of elegance and aesthetic effect. Pour paraître. Not only that, their daughters too, these innocent 17-year-old young things just out of school, even they know about the cotton wool. They know everything. The purpose of that cotton wool, and where precisely, in which parts, to apply the cotton wool. And they know, too, why, that is, with what end in view, all this is being used. Well now, I chuckled inwardly. All the care and trouble that is being taken, conscious care, about these cotton wool additions, is it really purer, more moral and more chaste than the wretched light garment taken with such naive certainty to the parent, the certainty that that is precisely what is called for, precisely the moral thing to do? For heaven's sake, my friends, do not think I now want to read you a lecture to the effect that civilization is not progress, and that latterly in Europe it has on the contrary always threatened all progress with whip and prison. Do not think that I shall try to prove that in our country we barbarously confuse civilization with the laws of normal and true progress, or that civilization has long ago been condemned even in the West, and that its one and only advocate over there is the capitalist, though everyone there is a capitalist or wants to be one, because he wants to save his money. Do not think that I shall try to prove that the human soul is not a tabula rasa, a piece of wax to be moulded into a pan homunculus, that the primary need is for nature, then for science, then for independent, unrestricted life deeply rooted in the soil, and finally for faith in one's own national powers. Do not think I shall pretend to be ignorant of the fact that our progressively minded men, though by no means all of them, are no defenders of cotton wool, and, in fact, brand it as they brand light garments. All I want to say now is that the article had an ulterior motive for censuring and condemning the light garments. It did not state simply that it was barbarism, but was exposing elemental, national, working-class barbarism in opposition to the European civilization of our aristocratic upper classes. The article swaggered. The article pretended not to know that those who were thus exposing this barbarism were themselves guilty of things perhaps 1,000 times worse and filthier, or that all we had done was to exchange one kind of prejudice and nastiness for another worse kind of prejudice and nastiness. The article pretended not to notice our own prejudice and nastiness. Why then, why should we look so cocky as we stand over the common people, arms akimbo, breathing contempt? For this faith in infallibility and in the right to make these exposures is absurd, laughably absurd. This faith is either simply swagger to impress the people, or else an unreasoning, slavish worship of the European forms of civilization, and this surely is even more absurd. But what's the use? Thousands of such facts could be found every day. Forgive me, my little story. However, mea culpa, for I have committed a fault. The reason is that I have jumped too hastily from grandfathers to grandsons. There were other facts in between. Remember Chatsky? He was neither an artlessly wily grandfather nor a self-satisfied grandson. Cocky and sure of himself, Chatsky was quite a special type of our Russian Europe, a pleasant, enthusiastic, suffering type, appealing to Russia and to firm foundations, and yet going back to Europe again when he had to find a place of refuge for man's wounded pride. In fact, a type which is useless now, but which was terribly useful in the past. He was a phrase-monger, a chatterbox, but a kind phrase-monger, sincerely sorry for his uselessness. Now, in the new generation, he is reborn, and, we believe, in youthful vigour. We trust that he will appear once again, but this time not suffering from hysteria, as at Famosov's ball, but as a conqueror, proud, mighty, meek, and loving. Besides, he will have realized by then that the place of refuge for wounded pride is to be found not in Europe, but perhaps under his very nose, and he will find something to do and will do it. And you know what? I, for one, am convinced we haven't only got sergeants of civilization and European faddists. I am convinced, I insist, that the new man is born already. But more of this later. Now I want to say a bit more about Chatsky. There is one thing I cannot understand. Chatsky was surely a very intelligent man. How is it that such an intelligent man failed to find himself a job of work to do? As a matter of fact, none of them had ever found themselves jobs of work to do. They failed to find them for 23 generations running. This is a fact, and it is surely no use arguing against facts, but one may always ask a question out of curiosity. Well now, I cannot understand how an intelligent man can fail at any time and in any circumstances to find himself a job of work to do. This, I am told, is arguable, but in my heart of hearts I do not believe it is. We are given intelligence in order to achieve our aims. If you cannot walk a mile, then walk at least 100 steps. It would anyway be better than nothing, or at least nearer your object if you have an object to go to. But if you insist on reaching your object step by step, this is not, in my estimation, intelligence. You could even be called work-shy in that case. We do not like toil, are not used to take one step at a time, and prefer to reach our object or become a second Regulus in one flying leap. But this is precisely to be work-shy. However, Chatsky was perfectly right at the time to slip away abroad again. A little delay would have sent him eastwards instead of westwards. People love the West in this country. They love it, and when it comes to a certain point, they all go there. I am going there too, as you see. Mais moi, c'est autre chose. I saw them all there, many of them, that is. There is no keeping count of them all, and all of them seem to be seeking a refuge for wounded pride. In any case, they are seeking something. The generation of Chatskys of both sexes after Famosov's ball, and generally speaking when the ball was over, increased and multiplied till they were as numerous out there as the sands of the sea. And not even the Chatskys alone, for everyone left Moscow to go abroad. There are goodness knows how many Repetilovs and Skullerzubs there, retired by now and dispatched to a watering place as unfit for further work. Natalia Dmitrievna and her husband are life members of these institutions. Even Countess Klestov is taken there every year. All these people are tired even of Moscow. Molchalin alone is not among them. He has made other arrangements and remained at home, the only one to have done so. He has, so to say, dedicated himself to his country, to his fatherland. He is unattainable now and wouldn't let Famosov inside his door. Country neighbours, the Famosovs, not the people to greet in town. He is in business and has found himself a job of work to do. He lives in St. Petersburg and has been successful. He knows Russia, and Russia knows him. Oh yes, knows him well, and will not forget him in a hurry. He is not even silent now. On the contrary, he is the only one to speak. He is the expert. But enough of him. I mentioned them all, saying that they were trying to find a happy spot in Europe, and really I thought they preferred it there. But in fact their faces register such bored melancholy. Poor things. How restless they all are, how morbidly and sadly always on the move. They all walk about with guidebooks and rush greedily in every town to see the sights, do it indeed, as if in duty bound, or as if they were still performing their state service. They would never miss a single palace, be it only three window size, if only it is mentioned in the guidebook. Not a single town mayor's residence, very similar to the most ordinary Moscow or Petersburg house. They stare at Rubens' meaty carcasses and believe that they represent the three graces because their guidebooks bid them believe it. They rush at the Sistine Madonna and stand in front of her in bovine expectation, the expectation that something will happen any minute now, that somebody will crawl out from underneath the floor and dispel their aimless, bored melancholy and fatigue. And then they go off surprised because nothing has happened. This is not the self-satisfied and perfectly mechanical curiosity of British tourists, men and women, who look more into their guidebooks than at the sights, do not expect anything either new or extraordinary, and merely check to see what the guidebook has to say and precisely how many feet or pounds any particular object measures or weighs. Our own curiosity is somehow savage, nervous, frantically eager, yet secretly convinced in advance that nothing will ever happen. Of course, till the very next fly that happens to buzz past when it all begins again. And I am now talking of intelligent people only. It is no use worrying about the others. God always looks after them, or about those who have made their home there, who are gradually forgetting their mother tongue and begin to listen to Catholic priests. However, there is only one thing to be said about the whole lot of them. As soon as we get beyond Eitkühnen, we all of us immediately become startlingly similar to those wretched little dogs which run about when they lose their master. You don't imagine, do you, that I'm sneering at anyone, or blaming somebody because, at the present time when, etc., you remain abroad, the peasant problem is in full swing and you remain abroad, and so on and so forth. Oh, not at all, not in the slightest. Besides, who am I to blame anyone? Whom should I blame, and for what? We would like to do some useful work, but there is no work, and what there is of it is being done without us anyway. All the jobs have been taken, and there are no vacancies in view. It's no use trying to barge in where there is no call for you. That's their whole excuse, and not a very impressive one at that. Besides, we know that excuse by heart. But what is this? Where did I get to? How have I had time to see the Russians abroad? We are only coming into Eitkühnen, or have passed it by now. In fact, we have. Berlin and Dresden and Cologne, we have passed them all. It is true I am still sitting in a railway carriage, but before us is Erkelin, and not Eitkühnen, and we are entering France. Paris. It's Paris I wanted to talk about, and forgot. That's because I let my thoughts wander on the subject of our Russian Europe, which is forgivable in a man who is himself on the way to visiting European Europe. But anyway, there is not need to insist on being forgiven. This chapter of mine is superfluous, as you will remember.